This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Despite all the information coming at us from TV, radio, and the internet, most of us only actually see the COVID-19 pandemic from where we are right now. That's one of the consequences of being asked to stay at home. But today's first guest has had the chance to see what's happening from both sides of the Pacific.
A magical night for Jeremy Lin.
He's the toast of New York.
Lin puts it up. Bang! Jeremy
Lin is probably best remembered for Lin's sanity, those 19 days in 2012 when he was the unlikely star of the New York Knicks. And last year, with the Toronto Raptors, he became the first Asian American to win an NBA title. Jeremy Lin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
So I want to start by taking you back to January. You were in China playing, as you've described it, with confidence and joy, averaging 24 points per game for the Beijing Ducks. Then COVID-19 hit and the season was suspended. At that time, were you really aware of the gravity of what was happening with this virus?
Definitely not. And, you know, I kind of wrote about it in a Players Tribune article, but for me, it was just I think it was just one of those things where it didn't really hit home, and I was kind of in a place where I was worn down with the season, so I was kind of just like really thinking only about myself, and it just didn't seem as real to me. It's definitely one of my big regrets, but I think blessing in disguise is that it allowed me to kind of launch my Be the Light campaign and to have a deeper conviction, kind of, at least, I guess it's not great that it came from not having conviction at all in the beginning, but at least the conviction came eventually.
So we're definitely going to talk more about the Be the Light campaign. But first, I want to take you through a little bit more of the timeline. So after the season was suspended, you flew home to California. What did you see when you were there? And what did you start to hear from other Asian Americans about what they were experiencing?
I think for me, just actually, honestly, it wasn't so much about what I was hearing or reading. It was real for me when I went back. And like, I remember talking to people and they're like, yeah, like, I don't know whether I should go to the grocery store or not. I'm like, what? Why wouldn't you? And they're like, I'm scared. Like, if I put on a mask, I feel like I may be attacked. And if I don't put on a mask, then I feel like I might get sick. And so it was kind of like dealing with those issues. And then even for me, at that time, California went into lockdown, so I actually had a mask and I was going to the grocery store to stockpile, and you know, I wasn't sure how long we were going to be in lockdown. And even when I was going to the grocery store, it became so clear that, like, yeah, people were looking at me a certain type of way, and I wasn't comfortable at all. And so that's when really for me, it became extremely real.
Wow. And how different is that from your normal experience?
I mean, normally, you know, especially, you know, for me, where I grew up in Northern California, it's very diverse. And so normally Asians don't have any issues in terms of just being out and about, and there's no looks that you'll get or anything. You know, obviously I've experienced that on the court, but, you know, from a day-to-day life standpoint, I've never experienced that. And on top of that, I would say the court is, you're talking about verbal and even online, and that's verbal, that's, but this is physical. When people look at you a certain type of way, or, you know, I think maybe it was Andrew Yang who kind of said, like, everybody knows somebody who's been attacked, or every Asian American knows another Asian American who is struggling with this. Like, that's true. And so going to the grocery store and being afraid for your health is very different than going to a basketball game and getting racist remarks thrown at you.
So then you flew back to China in March because the CBA season was scheduled to resume, and you were immediately put into quarantine. Can you describe that for me?
The quarantine? Oh, man, it's 14 days. You can't step outside the room. You can't come in contact with any human. The meals are dropped out outside your door 3 times a day. And then when you're done, you put the trash outside and someone else will come by and pick it up. It's a tiny little room, barely enough for just kind of a desk and a bed. So I actually ended up moving everything. I moved my chair, I moved my bed, I moved everything and pushed it as far into the corners as possible so that I could have a little bit of space to do my own workouts and stay in shape. And so, you know, I did crazy stuff. I was running from the door to the wall, and I did that 400 times. And I was doing that with, bouncing a basketball and doing different moves. And doing different weightlifting exercises, obviously without real weights or anything, but just trying to stay as much in shape. And so it was a unique experience, but it reminded me of just so many things that I kind of took for granted before.
And it also gave you a lot of time to think. So what conclusions did you start to reach as you had all this time, these 14 days?
Man, the first thing that I thought about was, okay, I'm here in a 14-day quarantine, but I'm quarantining mainly out of procedure and protocol. But my teammates had to quarantine for 21 days, a month. People in Wuhan had to quarantine for months at a time. And some of them, you know, and a lot of them were actually sick and dealing with that. And then I start to think about, you know, well, what happens if I did have it? What happens if I was sick? Or what happens if I was somebody who was sick and I lived alone? Or all these different thoughts that I was having, I was just like, wow, like, why didn't I take this more seriously earlier? And even a couple of days where I woke up with a sore throat, and it was really just a change in climate, and the fear that I had, you know, was very real.
So soon after that, you posted a video to your Instagram feed.
Hey guys, I never really make these types of videos, but with the coronavirus, I just, please hear me out. This is a tough time for everybody, and we need to unite. We need everybody to be a part of the solution. I'm just asking that you guys join me. I'm going to be donating to Feeding America and Direct Relief.
You said you don't usually make these kinds of videos. What inspired you to make one this time?
I just feel like, for me, social media has always kind of just been something, you know, I have my own style and I just post photos and I try not to have long captions and whatever. But recently, I mean, I'm just like, man, forget what my preferences are. It's like, I need to do whatever it takes. And so for me, I've been filming videos, I'm speaking into the cameras, I'm having very informative, long captions, which are normally my pet peeve. And even just asking people for something is just something I really don't like doing. I don't like asking people for anything. And so I think at this point, it's like, I'm at a point where I'm a little bit more desperate of like, hey, people are dying and people are hurting and the world is in some ways becoming more and more divided and hostile. What can I do to be a part of building bridges versus burning them?
Please consider being a part of this. We need to be light during a dark time. Thanks, guys.
You also wrote in the Players Tribune, quote, COVID-19 shouldn't be about East versus West, politics, race, or anything other than helping as many people as we can survive, serving as many hungry people as we can, comforting as many fearful people as we can, loving as many hurt people as we can, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And that was the official launch of your Be the Light campaign. How have people responded to what you wrote?
It's been very hot and cold. I would say there's definitely one group who are really upset and say certain things about me and attack my character and whatnot. And that's going to happen. That's, you know, that's just the reality of life. And I just tuned that out. You know, for me, it's like, look, I know what I'm doing. I know the money that I'm donating. I know my heart behind it all. And so on the flip, there's been so much positive reception, and that's far outweighed the negative reception. And the positive reception is, you know, even with Direct Relief and Feeding America, they're like, we've worked with a ton of athletes. We've worked with a ton of celebrities. What your campaign has done has been very, very impressive. I think at this point we have raised around $1.2 million, including my donations and matchings. But I think there's more coming in and there's other stuff that's going to be going on. And so, you know, I'm looking at some of these other campaigns and like, I'm looking at their numbers and how many followers they have. And I'm like, okay, if you just do simple math, like I have maybe like 1/15th or 1/20th or 1/30th of some of these followers. But when you actually look at them, like what my fans have done, again, it has nothing to do with, like, I'm not like tooting my own horn. I'm just saying I've been blown away at what happened and how people have rallied, and even other celebrities and other people who have been a part of it, even Lecrae coming on and joining forces.
You were talking about being a light. I say we all have opportunity to be light in the dark world.
It's been amazing to see just how many people want to help and are, you know, really interested in doing that.
One last thing before I let you go. You said in your Instagram post, and I'm going to do an exact quote here, when all is said and done, in and out on me. Can we hold you to that?
I got you. You want in and out? I got you. Just let me know. Well, hold on. Are you on the East Coast?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, hey, when we're both on the West Coast, I will get you as much in and out as you want. I can definitely do that for you. No problem.
Jeremy Lin, thanks so much. This has been great.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
We'll have links to Jeremy Lin's piece for the Players Tribune, The Darkness Has Not Overcome It, and how you can join him in supporting direct relief and feeding America at onlyagame.org.
Chill out, what she yelling for?
Jeremy Lin's not the only superstar athlete with nothing better to do than join us on Only a Game. Last month, U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe and future basketball Hall of Famer Sue Bird spoke with us about everything from the pandemic's especially bad timing for women's sports to their Instagram Live sing-alongs.
That was actually pretty just impromptu and random, to be honest.
The first one.
Which actually makes it even better. Mm-hmm. Totally not planned.
Check it out by subscribing to the Only a Game podcast, wherever you're getting your podcasts these days. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
I see the way you're acting like somebody else gets me frustrated.
All right, okay. I love you guys.
The first time Rachel Balkovec ran a minor league workout, it did not go well.
I know this is not the first time they've done a lunge. They know what to do, but I'm a new coach, I'm a girl, and I don't speak Spanish, so they're going to take advantage of that.
That story is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Right now, Rachel Balkovec should be in Tampa, Florida, working with a Yankees minor league affiliate as the first female full-time hitting coach for a Major League Baseball organization. But her first season on the job has been temporarily suspended by the pandemic. She's taking some of this time off to reflect on how she got here. Reporter Alex Schroeder has the story.
Rachel Balkovec has been playing sports for as long as she can remember. She's been coaching them forever, too, or at least since middle school.
You know, I was like the girl on the team that would tell everyone to show up early and we would do conditioning before practice. And I would, you know, the coaches in high school would give the post-game talk and then, like, I would give a post-game talk on top of it.
It's no surprise, then, to Rachel, to her former teammates, to her high school coaches, to her family members, that she's the first woman to be hired as a batting coach for a major league organization. But for the rest of the world, especially a lot of the sports world, it's been a different story. It took them a little more time to come around. It's something Rachel had to get used to.
I just, like, it was a hard realization of, like, okay, if somebody doesn't want to hire me because of my gender, that's probably just not a human being that I want to be around anyway.
Rachel played softball in college, but that's also when baseball entered her life, in two different ways. Her boyfriend was a pro prospect drafted into the Dodgers minor league system. Meanwhile, Rachel started a master's degree program in kinesiology at Louisiana State University. There she worked as a strength and conditioning coach for the Division I sports teams at LSU, including the powerhouse baseball team, which was fresh off a national championship.
So I was learning a lot there and kind of burgeoning my own career, but I was also just getting this wild fascination with the minor league system and the development of younger players and how they enter the system and where they go.
After graduating from LSU, Rachel got an internship with a low-level Cardinals minor league affiliate, the Rookie League Johnson City Cardinals.
I went from 110% intensity to, like, not so intense and very quiet and no fans. And I would say 95% of the players I was working with did not speak English and don't have any idea what SEC football or baseball or softball means, and they don't care.
Some of the players Rachel worked with were as young as 18. Some came from college ball, but many had just left home in the Caribbean or South America.
And so I showed up day one and I ran, or I thought I was going to run the stretch just like I ran it at LSU. And that went horribly. There was no structure. There was no, like, and I would say something and it's like, I know this is not the first time they've done a lunge. They know what to do, but I'm a new coach. I'm a girl and I don't speak Spanish. So they're going to take advantage of that, just like any smart teenager does.
So Rachel came up with a plan.
I basically, the second day, showed up with all of the dynamic warm-up phrases written down on a piece of paper, and I led the stretch in Spanish, and it went much better. And like, basically, they kind of, I think, were like, oh, dang, like, we're going to have to actually listen to her.
Since that second day of training with the Cardinals, Rachel has taught herself Spanish.
I think it did help me, especially as a woman, to have something to relate to them.
Rachel was named 2012 Appalachian League Strength Coach of the Year. So she had a master's degree, she had Spanish, she had worked with one of college baseball's premier programs, and now she was Strength Coach of the Year. But when her internship ended, the Cardinals said they didn't have a job for her. Rachel's next stop was Phoenix, where there are about 15 low-level minor league teams. In December, in anticipation of the upcoming season, she applied for open strength and conditioning positions at about 10 of them. She heard back from none.
And so I picked up a waitressing job, and about midway through spring training, I got a phone call from an organization and they said that one of their guys had quit. And they were asking if I was still local and I was still interested in the position. And I, of course, said yes. Interviewed a couple times with their coordinator. He said, you know what? You're our girl. I really like you. You're phenomenal, overqualified for this job. Like, we're lucky to have you. I'll call you in a couple of days. We'll get this process started with paperwork. Well, I never heard from him.
Rachel found that odd. She followed up. No response. 3 weeks passed. And then, finally, she got a call. It was the same strength and conditioning coordinator.
And he's, like, really apologetic. But he said, you know, I'd really like to hire you, but I'm not going to be able to, and it's because of your gender. And I am horrified by this. I apologize. He said he respects women. He wanted to hire me, but he couldn't do it. And he just wanted to be honest. And he was like, I want to let you know what you're up against.
Rachel had two immediate reactions. One, she was surprised because that's illegal. Two, she was actually grateful that he was honest with her because now she knew the truth.
And he was like, well, it also gets worse. And I thought, how could this possibly get worse? Because you just told me that you discriminated against me. And he said that he had taken so long to get back to me because he had called all of the other teams that he knew had open positions. And they said the same thing, that they had gotten my resume and that it just wasn't going to be possible because of my gender.
Rachel was in disbelief. What more could she do? But she says she never considered taking legal action.
Because I wouldn't be sitting here on this phone call if I had taken legal action. I wouldn't have a job. Yeah, I think a lot of women understand that, but harder for men to understand. Like, why wouldn't you just sue them? And it's like, well, any person who's been oppressed or discriminated against, and RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, said this, is you got to be deaf sometimes so that in the long run you can make a bigger impact. So I understood that I had an opportunity to open doors for other women. And if I didn't do it, I wasn't sure of who else would come behind me, and I wasn't sure of when they would come.
Rachel says it didn't even occur to her to stop trying. She actually just got more determined and more creative for the next round of applications.
And I was on the phone with my sister and kind of discussing how I was going to apply for jobs. And she said, well, why don't you change your name and see what happens? And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, change your name to a guy's name and see if you get responses.
Rachel did just that. On her next round of applications, she used the name Ray Balkovic.
R-A-E. And it worked. Really quickly, I got a phone call from a number I didn't know. I was kind of out and about, and I just answered, not thinking too much of it. And he said, can I speak to Ray? And I was like, I just was like, oh my gosh, it worked. So I said, this is she. And he kind of, like, there was like a shuffling of the papers on the other end. And he was like, oh, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I had the right name. And I just thought, well, there's only one way to say Ray. You just were surprised that it's a woman. So I was like, well, this really isn't a good time, but I'm really interested in this position. Can we talk tomorrow? He said, yep, no problem. I'll call you tomorrow. Never heard from him.
Rachel followed up with a call and an email. Still nothing. Finally, Rachel got an internship with a White Sox affiliate in Arizona. It paid $30 a day. Between that and her waitressing gig, she barely made enough money for gas. And when the internship was over, there was, once again, no full-time job waiting for her. Rachel figured she'd have to go another year without a legit baseball job. She was preparing to move to Boston, with no housing plans, to work unpaid in a facility there. And then, the Johnson City Cardinals, where she had won that Strength Coach of the Year award, came calling with a full-time job offer. It was the break Rachel needed.
I was pretty desperate, and like, I was hired as the first ever female strength and conditioning coach in the history of professional baseball, and definitely the first ever coordinator. And then the next day I overdrafted my account because I was so broke.
But things were looking up. Rachel was now responsible for overseeing 10 male strength coaches. And over the next 4 years, Rachel worked her way up in the minor league strength and conditioning ranks. In 2016, Rachel joined the Houston Astros organization, where she started working with several hitting coaches who also had backgrounds in kinesiology and strength and conditioning. She started thinking she could become a hitting coach too. But this would be an even bigger leap for Rachel. Most hitting coaches are former players. Of the 30 that currently serve MLB teams, only two never played pro ball. Just like when she had taught herself Spanish, Rachel once again went way beyond what most would do to chase a new challenge. She spent a year and a half in the Netherlands, getting another master's degree and training with some of the world's top researchers in human movement science and eye tracking for hitters. It put her on the cutting edge of the analytics work that more and more ball clubs are incorporating. Soon after she returned to the States, she heard from a fellow Houston Astros alum, Dylan Lawson, who is now a hitting coordinator with the New York Yankees. Eventually, he offered her a job.
I'd like to say it was just one day out of the blue, but it really wasn't. It was a continual conversation that developed over time.
On February 1st, 2020, Rachel Balkovic became the first female hitting coach for a major league affiliate when she started with the Gulf Coast League Yankees.
I like remember rolling into the parking lot of the complex, and I'm like walking past the building with the Yankees logo and all of the championships listed, and a Yankees uniform is hanging in my locker, you know, and really the thing that truthfully comes to mind is reflecting on like, what would my grandmothers say about this?
Part of Rachel's new job is pitching during batting practice, but having grown up playing softball, it hasn't been easy to adjust to throwing a baseball. Her players don't seem to mind.
If I throw a strike, they're like cheering me on, you know, they're like, yeah, that's right, you know, or like I'll throw a strike and a guy will take it. And they're like, what's wrong with you? Like, swing at that.
Rachel and the team had about 6 weeks of training together before the coronavirus forced everyone to leave. Currently, she's staying at an Airbnb in Utah while she's waiting to return to baseball. And she set up a GoFundMe campaign to help with COVID-19 relief. Rachel adds $5 of her own money every day, and every week she donates to a different cause. Food banks, medical supplies.
After we were sent home, I just kind of felt helpless. And I was like, wait, I'm not helpless. I can do something.
So when Rachel agrees to share her story with media outlets like Only a Game, she asks for a $10 donation to the GoFundMe in return. It's an unusual arrangement journalistically, but these are unusual times. Rachel has raised about $5,000 so far, and she's been practicing her pitching during this downtime. At first, she was throwing against the fence at a nearby Little League field. But then, one day Rachel told her Airbnb host what she does for a living and asked if she could throw batting practice for her host's 3 baseball-playing sons.
This mom was just, like, beside herself. She's like, wait, I'm sorry, you coach for the Yankees and you're staying in my Airbnb, like, apartment on the back of our house?
Imagine how she'll react after hearing the rest of Rachel Balkovec's story.
That's reporter Alex Schroeder. Back when reporter Dan Simmons was a kid growing up in Minnesota, he remembers sitting down with his brothers to watch a movie their father rented from the public library. It was called Running Brave, and it told the story of an unlikely American hero at the 1964 Olympics in Tokyo. Later, one of Dan's brothers would re-watch the movie the night before every high school cross-country or track race. With the Olympics scheduled to return to Tokyo, eventually, Dan decided to check in with the man whose life inspired the film.
The sun hangs low in the late afternoon sky. It's October 14th, 1964. National Olympic Stadium, Tokyo. The runners toe the line for the 10,000-meter race.
Boom, the gun goes off. 26 years old, an officer in the Marine Corps, married, one child.
That's one of the many runners in this race. His name is Billy Mills. This race belongs to Ron Clark. He's an Australian who holds the world record in this event. An announcer puts it plain about Billy's chances.
Billy Mills of the United States is in there, a man no one expects to win this particular event.
Billy Mills was born on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, located inside South Dakota. He lived the generational poverty familiar to all on Pine Ridge. His mother died when he was 8. His father died when he was 12. He arrived at the University of Kansas in 1958 on an athletic scholarship. Billy was successful on the track. During college, he ran to multiple All-American finishes in cross-country. At one of those national meets, Billy got ready for the post-race photo with his fellow All-Americans. He thought of his parents and how proud they'd be.
Then I heard one photographer, you, yeah, you, the darker-skinned one, I want you out of the photo. And that just went to the depths of my soul, and it broke me.
He went back to his hotel near Louisville. Later that day,
I'm on a chair. I opened the window, and it took years for me to share this because I thought it was weakness. I thought it was cowardly. I'm on the chair. You don't want to kill yourself. I just wanted to go where it was quiet. I looked out the window, and 3.5 or so floors down to the ground and then a little slope. And my thoughts were, it'll all be over. But then I didn't jump. I didn't jump because I didn't hear through my ears, underneath my skin, through energy, an unspoken word, which sounded like, don't. And the fourth time, so gentle, so loving, but so commanding, like an echo, don't. And it sounded like my dad's voice. I'm crying. I step off the chair. I'm thinking about what he told me when the 3 years after my mom died, and then before he died, he would tell me that it takes a dream to heal broken souls. I got off the chair, crying, and I wrote down a dream to heal a broken soul. Gold medal, Olympic 10,000-meter run.
Back on campus, a week or so after that night in the hotel room, a beautiful young woman caught Billy's eye.
I turned and I followed her. I don't know if you'd call that stalking or not. And we eventually met. I fell in love right away, and eventually she fell in love. And as I shared my stories and my struggles and my fears, but my dreams with her, she became this incredible support system. I supported her dreams. She supported my dreams. And my life slowly started to change around.
Billy and Patricia Mills got married as college seniors. Tokyo, October 14th, 1964. It's halfway through the 25-lap Olympic race, and Billy is shocking everyone. He's with the leaders. He runs close to his fastest 5-kilometer time ever, but there's still another 5K to go. 12.5 laps. It's a punishing pace.
I came so close to quitting. I looked into the infield. If there's nobody there that recognized me, I was going to quit. Everybody was local Japanese officials. Anywhere was a great place to quit. I looked into the stadium. Who did I focus on? My wife. She's crying. There's no way I could quit. We made a commitment together.
The stadium lights go on. Darkness descends. The 10,000-meter race is one of attrition. It's the longest race in track and field. An American had never won it. As the laps pass, Billy is with the leaders, including world record holder Ron Clark of Australia. They surge periodically. The pack thins.
About a mile to go, Clark made a move. It came so close to breaking me. I said I had to cover it now. I covered the move. I took the lead, slowed it just a fraction. Clark took the lead again, but I recovered. 2 laps to go, Clark looked back. I thought, my God, he's worried.
All runners running hard. They're really pouring on the steam right now.
Billy joined the Marine Corps in 1962, but he didn't stop running. And in the year leading up to the 1964 Olympics, Billy got a commission from the Marine Corps to focus on training while at Camp Pendleton. There, he got a new coach.
Tommy Thompson Sr., formerly the coach at the Naval Academy, Canadian, gold medalist in the high hurdles. He came up to me and said, son, so gentle. I'm so glad you're here. You have a lot of talent. Now, I'm not going to coach you. More importantly, I want to be your mentor. But you have to let me inside. You have to let me know your dreams. And he tapped his heart. You've got to let me inside of your heart. I thought, my gosh, this is like my dad speaking to me. This is like God sending my dad's spirit to me through Tommy Thompson Sr. I opened up my heart to him.
One lap to go. It's a three-man race. Ron Clark of Australia and Mohamed Gamoudi of Tunisia lead. Fast on their trail is Billy. On the final turn before the finish, Clark and Gamoudi are still out front. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, as they run down the home stretch toward Olympic glory.
You can hear people screaming, but it's quiet. You can see reactions if you looked in the crowd, but it's slow motion. The tape breaks across my chest. I won. An official came up and said, who are you? And I said, oh my God, did I miscount the laps? He said, finished. You're the new Olympic champion.
Shortly after finishing, Billy reunited in the stadium with his wife, Pat. The two embraced, and he told her,
Pat, I healed a broken soul. I healed a broken soul. And in the process, I became an Olympic gold medalist.
Billy found himself suddenly famous.
First telegram I read was from Colonel John Glenn, challenging me to a race. He was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps as a pilot. And he said, if he can't beat me in his motorcycle, he reserves the right, since he outranks me, to use his spacecraft.
The eyes of the world were on Billy. But he had been feeling uneasy, even during the medal ceremony.
The national anthem is being played. It was beautiful. It was powerful. There's total love for our country. Our country I was willing to give my life for as an officer in the United States Marine Corps. But I also felt part of me did not belong. And then I struggled with that.
Billy dedicated the rest of his life to empowering American Indians. In 1986, he co-founded a nonprofit. It's called Running Strong for American Indian Youth. Throughout his life, Billy has received many accolades, including the NCAA's top honor. He had a middle school in Kansas named after him. In 2013, President Barack Obama awarded Billy the Presidential Citizens Medal, the nation's second highest civilian honor, for his work with Running Strong. But Billy points to another honor as perhaps the most meaningful.
When the Anti-Defamation League gave me the highest award they give to address hate, addressing, taking a stand against hate on a global basis. That's been my life from the day I won the gold medal.
Today, Billy Mills, age 81, lives in Sacramento with Pat. They've been married 58 years. They raised four daughters who now have their own families. When the Summer Olympics head back to Tokyo for the first time since 1964, Billy plans to bring the family, plus one. A 14-foot bronze made by an American Indian sculptor that they hope will be displayed in Tokyo during the Games. The statue shows Billy charging down the home stretch, arms pumping and knees driving, on that October night 55 years ago that changed his life.
That's reporter Dan Simmons. On a recent Tuesday morning, sports writer Nora Princiati attempted a sprints workout designed for NFL players. How did it go?
Oh, it was horrible. And like, I like to run, but I would never sprint unless forced. It's not something that I would ever do.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only A Game NPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, we meet the man who kept his 100-mile ultra-marathon streak alive by running 13,200 laps around his living room in Brooklyn. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
NBA teams aren't expecting guidance on when the league will return until June 1st, but that hasn't stopped The Athletic from reporting that the most likely scenario puts all of the games in Disney World. I still love this idea, but it might just be because I miss Disney World.
Well, I mean, it will be the completion of Disney/ESPN's total swallowing of professional sports.
Right.
Where are they going to hang around Epcot and then play a couple of games? It's not an uninteresting idea, but it's also going to be a very, very strange way to play basketball.
Major League Baseball sent a 67-page health and safety proposal to its players last weekend. The document covers everything from how often everyone would be tested every day, at least to start, to the recommendation that players not shower in the locker room. They seem to have thought of everything, don't you think?
All of these proposals are dependent upon actually playing the games, and there's nothing in here that I can see about the fans who are not going to be allowed to watch, which is going to be strange in its own right.
Some players are asking why, if everyone's going to get tested every day, they can't just high-five and spit sunflower seeds like they usually would. Would you like to explain?
Yeah, because you don't want to catch this virus and be compromised in your respiratory system for the rest of your life. I mean, it doesn't work that way. If you get tested at 9 o'clock in the morning, you can wind up getting the virus at 9:15. Testing is basically a snapshot.
We've got a good news, bad news situation in Tokyo, Charlie. Would you like the good news first?
Absolutely.
So the IOC will pay $650 million towards the cost of delaying the Olympics for a year, which, considering the IOC was taking the hard line of that's Tokyo's problem, seems pretty okay, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a while for the IOC to launder the money, but, you know, as soon as they get it clean, it'll go to Tokyo.
Okay, bad news. If the games can't be held in 2021, the IOC is now saying, better luck next time, Tokyo. Thanks for the $15 billion you've already spent. We're moving on to Paris 2024.
You can't have Fisher cut bait time for 2 years. You've got to either decide to hold these things or not. The athletes are up in the air. The athletes who are at the end of their Olympic careers, they don't have any idea what's going to happen. They've got one more Olympic Games in them, and they don't know if they're going to occur at all. So I don't find the IOC's proposal there that unreasonable. It pains me greatly to say that, by the way, but it's true.
And finally, Charlie, the German Bundesliga has returned to play, and already we have our first scandal. Augsburg manager Heiko Herrlich missed his team's return to play a 2-1 loss after being banned from the game for breaking quarantine a few days earlier. I mean, quarantine is important, so he must have had a good reason to leave, right?
Look, dental hygiene is important, too. He went out to buy toothpaste.
And face cream.
You know, you got your beauty routine and your teeth. I mean, the guy just wanted to look good on TV. I don't have a problem with this at all. I want to know who ratted him out. Was it the guy at the drugstore who ratted him out?
I don't know. We need an investigation, clearly.
We do.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of The Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
On a recent Tuesday morning, Boston Globe sports writer Nora Princiati walked 2 miles from her apartment to an empty-ish park along the Charles River to attempt a fitness test designed for NFL players. Why would she do such a thing? We thought we'd ask her. Hi, Nora.
Hello, Karen.
All right, so let's start with the inspiration behind this folly. It all began when you were working on a story about how NFL players are staying in shape without being able to go to gyms and to team training facilities. I think most people would assume that pro athletes all have huge basements filled with workout equipment, but that's not what you found, right?
Yeah, no, not at all. And I mean, I covered these guys every day and I was really surprised. I just was hearing so many stories about, you know, offensive linemen pushing their trucks up and down their driveways and waiting 3 weeks to get a set of resistance bands off Amazon.
Well, Patriots captain Matthew Slater told you that he's using his kids as human weights. And I can't really decide if I want him to be joking or if I want that to be true.
I feel like it's probably true. Like, his kids are young, so you could kind of, you know, you could do a little bit of like a bicep thing.
All right. So you talked to trainer Yo Murphy. He works with a bunch of pro athletes. So what kind of things has he come up with to keep his clients in shape?
For skill position guys, like certainly quarterbacks, cornerbacks, wide receivers, running backs, like those guys, they can use their own body weight and some lightweights and resistance stuff. Where it gets really challenging is when you have 300-pound athletes who have to be capable of just moving other people's bodies on a football field. So I think a lot of what he's been doing is kind of being a person for his clients who can say, okay, no, we're not giving up. Let's brainstorm. You got to be kind of creative. And I think in some ways that was why I was interested in the story, is that at least a little bit of it sounded familiar enough that I was like, huh. Maybe I could try to do what they are doing.
And so this trainer, Yo Murphy, is the one who told you about this fitness test you tried out in that park along the Charles River. So what is the test and why does Murphy use it?
So this is something that he'll have his guys do like once every 2 weeks or so. And the way that it works is you set a timer. I set it for 10 minutes. Bigger guys only do it for 8 minutes. And you don't have a set number of sprints that you have to do. It's just that you're sprinting 80 yards, then you're jogging back the other way, and you can rest when you get to the end, or you can go right ahead and sprint again. But the goal is to push yourself and get as many sprints in as you can in the 8 or 10 minutes, but then also to use that number as something that you can track over time. We talked about a bunch of different workouts that guys were doing, but that was one that didn't involve pushing trucks. You know, I can run. I was like, okay, I'll try this one.
Really? Because when I hear you describe that, it does not sound like fun.
Oh, it was horrible. I hated it. And like, I like to run, but I would never sprint unless forced. It's not something that I would ever do.
All right, so take me to that Tuesday morning. As you were making your way from your apartment to the park, were you feeling confident? Were you feeling nervous?
Sort of neither. I just figured it would be fine. I can run for a long distance, so the idea of doing something for 10 minutes, I was like, okay, whatever. So I was just strolling over. It was a really nice morning. Little did I know how painful it would be.
How did the first sprint feel? Was it awful right from the bat?
No. So it was fine, except that, you know, so I run with a face covering and I started going and I was like, oh gosh, I might choke on this because it's like going into my mouth. And I'm like, oh, this is such a bad setup. So we had a little bit of a mechanical issue.
Did you ever think about quitting?
No. But I did think about, I could just totally mail this in. I never thought about lying about the number of sprints that I completed. I care very much about our Boston Globe readers, but like, I was able to do 10. If I only did 9 sprints for them, you know, the world will continue turning on its axis. So I did have that thought, but I was never going to stop running. You know, the conclusion that I came to is that the way that professional athletes exercise, it's not only is it different from what I do, I just don't need to do it. That's not the point of working out for me. When I finished it, I was kind of like, I don't even know if I feel particularly proud of myself for doing this. This just has no bearing on my life, and I'm never doing it again.
But as you mentioned, the whole point of this thing is that you do it more than once so that you can track your progress. So I don't want to call you a wimp for not doing it again, but have you really accomplished the goal if you only do it once?
Well, probably not. I think you're kind of like, you're right. I am a wimp. But that's the point, Karen. I'm a wimp. Like, ultimately, I was approaching this exercise as a reporter, not as an athlete, in air quotes. And therefore, I think I had accomplished my goal, even if it wasn't in line with the goals of the actual athletes who do this. That was my excuse that I made for myself to never do it again.
Nora Princiati is a sports writer for the Boston Globe. Nora, thanks for being such a good sport.
Thank you, Karen. I appreciate it.
Naming no names, a person gets tired of humanity now and then. She wants silence and a reacquaintance with her own thoughts, if any are left.
That's commentator Alyssa Eli. And even though she wrote this essay a few years back, I think it feels pretty relevant today.
I found a remote mountain loop where there would be very little chance of running into anyone else with a Luna bar and a set of carbon hiking poles. I brought the dog. She was tired of humanity, too. 2 liters of water and the 10 essentials for hiking safety. The day was glorious, with wind and the sounds of nearby water. It was a pleasure to be so far from people. Misery and defeat a few hours in. There was nothing but up. A hard New Hampshire up, with no switchbacks for relief. It dawned on me that we might not make it much farther. The dog had already reached this conclusion. She furrowed her brow and sat. What seemed like an unpassable rock mass appeared in the distance. When we came closer, we could see what it actually was, 4 small boulders. They'd been levered into a set of stairs, fit so tightly together you could see tool marks. Above them were more levered boulders, a second set, and a third flight of steps above that. In the middle of nowhere, someone had built the stairway to heaven. Some crew of strong, sweating, perhaps shirtless workers had carried shovels, levers, and hammer drills all these miles to nowhere, and back again afterwards. They'd jimmied rocks into steps for the benefit of hikers they would never meet. We were anonymous to them. But that made no difference. They knew we'd be coming. Revived, the dog vaulted up. I followed, and from the top, breathing easier, looked down, way down. These stairs were miraculous. People, I thought, are truly marvelous.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist. That essay first aired back in 2016. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.